This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Tomorrow, Super Tuesday, and one of the big questions, how strong will the youth turnout be? College campuses across the country, there are reports of energized student bodies ready to go to the polls, but historically, translating that energy into actual voting has been easier said than done. Joining us to talk about their sense of what it's going to be like for their colleagues in college is David Phelps, Los Angeles County Director of California Young Democrats and a member of the Executive Board for the California Democratic Party. Mr. Phelps, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
I assume you're not too long out of college, that you have some sense of what's going on at campuses, as well as recent graduates who are energized. What's your sense of how this is going to play out?
Well, Larry, certainly from the turnout that has been occurring in the first few primaries and caucuses, young voters are very engaged in the presidential election this year. And it's not only 2008, they showed marked increases, young voters, in turnout in 2006 and in 2004. And we're seeing a trend here that young voters are increasingly engaged. They feel it's very important to be educated about the issues and civically involved. And we are seeing voter turnout in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina doubling and even tripling in many cases, showing that young voters this year are very focused on the presidential election and who will be leading our country for the next 4 years.
You know, I think back to the 1960s when young voters were really energized in opposition to the Vietnam War, and we started seeing a huge impact of the youth vote. You know, this time, of course, there's the controversial war in Iraq, but it seems that's not so much the motivator among younger voters as it is the excitement over the chance for history to be made with the candidacies of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton.
Well, what we're going to have is either the first female Democratic nominee ever elected or the first African-American ever elected, and I think that there is a certain appeal to that. But I also think that young voters are increasingly more focused on the issues that are important to them, that are going to be impacting them as they enter adulthood, which is, you know, higher education, affordable health care, affordable housing for everyone, and also America's place in the world. I think all of those are factors that are playing into the motivation of why young voters are more engaged than they've ever been.
Also joining us is Sean Fagot, the president of the Orange County Young Republicans and vice chairman of the Young Republican Federation of California. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
Well, I'm wondering on the Republican side where, at least today, and this, of course, could change, the leading Republican candidate is a 72-year-old man. Has that had any impact one way or the other on younger Republicans?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I personally thought that most of the young Republicans were leaning towards Rudy Giuliani initially. Now that he is no longer in the race, there's somewhat of a fight between the McCain and the Mitt Romney campaigns to kind of capitalize on that group of people who are now kind of there without a candidate. So I would suggest that the young voters are not necessarily as enthused as young Democrats are in this election cycle. There's a lot of infighting going on among younger people, and it's really kind of been a little bit more difficult to motivate our folks, to be perfectly honest with you.
Love to hear from younger Air Talk listeners your thoughts about tomorrow's Super Tuesday, and what in the conversations you're having with your friends and colleagues at school or in the workplace, your thoughts on where younger voters are going to go, and are you seeing a particular enthusiasm among voters under 30? 866-893-KPCC. Maybe you're a first-time voter. This will be your first opportunity to vote, particularly in a presidential race. 866-893-5722. Mr. Fagot, on the Republican side, when you say your sense was Rudy Giuliani was garnering the most support, is that indicative that for younger Republicans that the issues that Rudy Giuliani staked his campaign around were more their issues, or was it more the force of his personality?
I think it was a combination of things, but probably more of a force of personality than anything else. Most of the candidates on the Republican side, as you know, of course, there are small differences between them all, but generally they all have kind of adopted, you know, very similar campaign platforms. So as far as ideology and issues are concerned, I don't think that weighed into as much as cult of personality.
Do you see among younger Republicans the same kind of spread on issues and differences that you do among older Republican voters?
What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, say, social conservatives versus, you know, live and let live Republicans on social issues, but fiscal conservatives. Do you see
right.
that same kind of ideologically different? Or would you say that for younger Republicans, there are certain trends that do stand out?
Well, I think this election cycle, we are seeing very much a divide along the lines of social conservatives and social moderates. And that's borne out between the Romney and McCain campaigns. You know, there's some fierce differences between those two groups of people, and it's really starting to get a little bit divisive amongst the rank and file, and it's really kind of disturbing me a lot. So absolutely, that's where the divide line is social conservatives versus non-social conservatives.
And does that often link up to religious belief that the social conservatives in California tend to be more evangelical Christians, or do you not necessarily see that?
That plays into it. You know, if you're an evangelical Christian, that would definitely probably sway you towards the social conservative end of the spectrum. But, you know, this is kind of a long battle that the Republican Party has been trying to deal with. And every now and again, it raises its ugly head. And I think this election cycle is going to be one of the most potent examples of that kind of uneasy coalition between social conservatives and fiscal conservatives.
Sean Fagot is president of the Orange County Young Republicans. David Phelps is Los Angeles County Director of California Young Democrats. Mr. Phelps, is there that division between Democrats with those who support Senator Obama versus those who support Senator Clinton?
Well, I think that there's an equal amount of excitement about a Democrat being in the White House in 2008. I've heard, you know, opinions on both sides about why they're supporting Clinton and why they're supporting Obama. But I think the important point to make here, Larry, is that regardless of who the nominee is after, you know, February 5th and continuing, that Democrats, young Democrats in particular, if they vote three times a row in an election for the same party, they are most likely to vote with that party for the rest of their adult lives. And what we've seen here, both in 2004 and in 2006, is that young voters, by a margin of 2-1, are increasingly voting for the Democratic Party. And we've seen, based on the trends in Iowa and New Hampshire and the early primaries and caucuses, that that trend will be continuing. So we are very excited about that.
I wonder, though, if Senator McCain ends up being the Republican nominee, are you concerned about him peeling away some younger voter support among moderates?
Not at all, Larry. We believe that whomever the honoree is, it will be a Democrat in 2008, and that young voters, as I said before, agree with the values and the goals of the Democratic Party, and that they'll be voting with that candidate in November.
All right. David Phelps and Sean Fagot giving us a sense of where younger voters are lining up. Lauren in West Los Angeles, welcome to Air Talk.
Hi.
Hi, Lauren.
How are you?
Good, thanks. You're a younger voter?
I am. I'm 22 years old.
Very good.
And I'm a Republican.
Okay.
And McCain being so central, I would say, is the reason I'm not voting for him. His stance on illegal immigration is the primary reason why I'm going with Romney.
So you're a younger voter going for Romney. Now, do you have other young Republican friends? Do you have a sense of, is there the kind of division that Sean Fagot was talking about?
All the people that I know that are voting Republican, I do have, living in L.A., quite a few Democratic friends, but all the people that I know that are Republican are going towards Romney because of McCain's stance, mostly on illegal immigration, actually. That seems to be the breaking point.
Interesting. All right, Lauren, thanks very much. We appreciate your weighing in with your thoughts on it. Marissa in Woodland Hills, welcome to Air Talk.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning, Marissa. So you're a younger voter?
I am considered, I guess, by your standards, a younger voter.
All right, very good. And where are you at? Are you energized by this process?
I think everyone's kind of energized on this. I think there's a consensus among younger voters that they're going more towards the issues and less towards their party.
And I wanted to ask you about that, because we, of course, see that registration among declined to state has gone up around the country, and particularly here in California. And it's been observed that a lot of that does have to do with younger voters who don't have the party loyalty that perhaps their parents did. And you've seen this?
Right. One thing that I'm also seeing that I wanted to bring attention to are first-generation Americans. A lot of people whose parents immigrated here had a trend of not voting, and if they were to engage the young voters who are first-generation Americans into voting. I'm noticing that, and I've tried to engage friends in my workplace whose parents didn't vote or are first-generation Americans into voting.
All right. Marissa, thanks very much. Great to talk with you. Dan in Santa Monica, welcome to Air Talk. Dan, are you there? Well, Dan,
hello?
Yeah, hi, go right ahead.
Am I on?
Yeah, but apparently not quite ready to go. Dan wanted to make the point that Democrats represent change and that that's what young people want. Let me ask Democrat David Phelps about that. Has the change message of Barack Obama been particularly effective with younger voters?
Well, I think that you can see that there is a large enthusiasm for his candidacy, and I do think that the issue and theme of change has certainly been a significant one. What I do see amongst young voters is that while they are skeptical of much of the information that's made available by campaigns and to a certain extent the mainstream media because of its polarizing and partisan nature, they are increasingly, they feel that it's important to be civically engaged. And I think that with the young voters here, I think that there is a certain message that's being given not only by Obama but also Clinton that young voters are playing an increasingly important role in our society, and that the issues that are important to them should be important to the President of the United States.
Change has certainly become the buzzword, no question about that. We thank you very much, David Phelps of Los Angeles County, Director of California Young Democrats, and Sean Fagot, President of Orange County Young Republicans. Great to have your thoughts on the excitement among younger voters on this Super Tuesday tomorrow and the California primary specifically. Michael in Santa Monica wanted to raise the point that Ron Paul has been a particularly attractive to young voters. Paul is the small L libertarian who's running on the Republican side and has really energized web-savvy voters and younger voters as well. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio.
California Report stories on 89.3 KPCC are made possible by the Evelyn and Walter Haas Jr. Fund, the AARP and its 3 million California members working to ensure access to affordable quality health care for all Californians, online at aarp.org, and by OSH, Complete Home and Garden Service to Californians for over 75 years, ideas, tips, and solutions at osh.com. A new national poll suggests John McCain is sitting on a double-digit lead over his closest rival, Mitt Romney. CNN Opinion Research says McCain has the backing of 44% of those responding, compared to Romney's 29%. The same survey shows a dead heat between Democrats, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama. Bill Clinton spent yesterday morning visiting churches here in the Southland, hoping to build support for his wife's campaign. But outside an African-American church the former president didn't visit, Senator Obama appeared to have the edge in the Democratic primary.
I like the idea that at least he's forthcoming with an agenda to unite people from all demographics. And I don't really hear that from anybody else. And if I do hear it, it seems like they're copycatting him. Mm-hmm. So I give him a chance off that. You know, I know he has the opportunity to make history, but that's what's drawing me to him.
That's 27-year-old Latif LaFall, who attended early mass at St. Bernadette Catholic Church in Baldwin Hills. LaFall is taking a political science class at Santa Monica College. He said it has helped him to choose a candidate. Well, if you want to hear the results of tomorrow's Super Tuesday primaries, you'll want to keep listening to KPCC. We'll be starting our primary coverage at 5 p.m. with the results of the voting along with in-depth analysis. That's tomorrow here on 89.3 KPCC. There's a SIG alert right now at LAX on the 405 South La Cienega on-ramp that's closed for Caltrans work. It's 11:21.
This coming Sunday at the Egyptian Theater on Hollywood Boulevard in Hollywood, big day for us, a Film Week on Air Talk is going to be bringing you our annual Academy Award preview program. I'll be joined by all the critics there at the Egyptian as we talk about the major categories of the awards. We look forward to having you join us. You can just come on down and purchase your tickets at the door. It's that easy. This coming Sunday at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood. The date, by the way, is February 10th, 1:30 in the afternoon. We'd love to have you in the audience. We always have a blast with this program. A 90-minute expanded edition of Film Week to talk about the Academy Awards. And it's looking ever more likely that there will be a televised Academy Awards show as marathon negotiations reportedly took place Friday between the Writers Guild of America and a bargaining session that was attended by several of the top studio leaders. Richard Verrier, the Los Angeles Times, has been covering the story. Richard, thanks for joining us again.
Hi, Larry. You are?
Hi. Well, I understand there's a media blackout, which makes your job all the tougher to get information, but you've cultivated some sources. What are they telling you?
Well, you're right. It has been difficult to track this during the blackout, but from what we understand, they did make major headway on Friday in resolving their key differences, particularly in the area of internet residuals that had held up earlier talks, and that's created a lot of optimism that they're close to reaching a deal. What we understand is that they've outlined the basic terms of a deal, and now they're going to be haggling over contract language, and that's certainly an important phase in all of this, and it's not done yet, but there's growing optimism that a contract could be presented to members, or at least presented to the board of the Writers Guild, possibly by Friday.
Do you have any information on specifics as to the terms that have been agreed to?
Don't know actual specifics. From what I've heard, it's the agreement is basically modeled on the contract that directors negotiated with studios. Directors got a doubling of the residual rate they receive on movies and TV shows that are sold online. They also got some jurisdiction for shows that are created for the web. I believe that writers got similar terms. They might have gotten some improvements in the area of streaming. One concern was that many writers had with the director's deal was that the streaming payments the directors have been offered were too low. And I don't have the specifics at this point, but from what we understand, the writers negotiated somewhat improved terms in that area.
All right. And on the issue of jurisdiction, there was the reality programming and animation that was in play. Those were totally taken off the table in these most recent talks?
Right. The writers took that off the table earlier to kind of jumpstart this process, and that was a significant concession on their part. Their demands to organize or to unionize writers in reality TV and feature animation. The studios had viewed those as sort of non-starters, and so the writers took that off the table, and that was an important concession.
All right, Richard Verrier, the Los Angeles Times, talking with us about negotiations between striking writers and the producers' organization, meetings that were attended by News Corp's president, Peter Chernin, by Robert Iger, the head of Walt Disney. How big, Richard Verrier, was it in having the studio chiefs take part in the negotiations? Do you think that was in any way responsible for moving this forward? And if so, why?
Yes, I think so. I mean, the Writers Guild negotiators had long complained about the way negotiations were conducted previously, where the top CEOs weren't in the room. Instead, talks were handled by a large group of a dozen or so labor relations executives led by Nick Counter, the president of the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, which represents the studios. And the complaint was that that group had trouble making decisions by reaching consensus, and it was very slow-moving. and that they really weren't making much headway. What in the latest round of negotiations, the talks on the studio side were led by Chernin and Iger, and they apparently were able to move this forward pretty quickly. That seems to have been an important factor.
Will this be rather close to the deal that the directors made a couple of weeks ago?
Yes. I mean, I have to stress this deal is not done yet, and you know, negotiations are still going on. But my understanding is that it is largely modeled on the deal the directors negotiated a few weeks ago, and but there will be some improvements for the writers. And part of that is also a reflection of the fact that the Screen Actors have also raised some concerns about the director's deal in some areas, particularly the streaming payments. And perhaps the studios were, you know, in recognition of that, wanted to come up with terms that would also satisfy not just the writers but also the actors, because their contract is coming up next. It expires in June.
Do you think that there is any indirect linkage between the two, that if writers are able to agree with producers on a deal, that somehow turns down the heat with SAG, or are their issues independent and not related to what happens with the writers?
Well, that's a good question. It's a key question right now, because the actors are next up at the table, I think. In some respects, this agreement could satisfy some of the actors' concerns. The actors' major concerns were had to do with the residual payments that they said were meager. For example, the studios offered directors fixed residual payments of $1,200, and the actors complained that was just a small fraction of what they get on a network rerun. So that figured to be a major sticking point, and to the extent they've offered better terms, that could satisfy the actors, but it's not clear at this point. There's some issues that the actors are far more concerned about than the writers. For example, home video, getting an increase in the DVD residuals. That's a big issue for the actors. The writers had decided to not pursue that in their negotiations.
Richard Verrier, the Los Angeles Times, has been covering the labor dispute and the strike between the Writers Guild of America and the Producers Umbrella Organization that has been negotiating on behalf of the studios and production entities. Now, Hollywood is an industry that works with often long lead times, particularly for feature films. You have any sense of the timetables if the board signs off on this Friday, and then you know, if rank and file takes a vote and approves this, how long it would take to get things actually to market, actually on air, or you know, going again on the feature film side?
I'm told it would take, on the television side, it would take several weeks before production would get ramped up again. On the feature film side, feature films haven't been nearly as adversely affected by this strike as television production. This strike mostly has affected scripted television production, which pretty much ground to a halt late last year. And it would take perhaps 2 months for some of these shows to get back up into production.
All right. Richard Verrier, thank you very much. Great to talk with you. And we'll keep our fingers crossed that both sides can come out of this happy with a deal and things can get back to working in Hollywood again. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
Richard Verrier, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, will, of course, keep you abreast of any new developments. There is an official media blackout that's in effect on both sides as they try and hammer out a deal. But at least what sources are telling journalists who've been closely covering this, that progress is being made, and it could be as soon as this Friday that the board of the WGA has a contract on which to take a vote. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We continue with an entertainment industry theme going. Brad Bird, the wonderful director of Ratatouille and other animated features, joining us next on Air Talk here on 89.3. This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We continue with the terrific animator and writer Brad Bird, responsible for three terrific feature-length animated films, going back to The Iron Giant, a real gem of hand-drawn animation. Then with Pixar Disney, he moved into the whole digital computerized animated age, working, of course, with a project near and dear to his heart, creating The Incredibles, which was not only a box office hit, but a huge critical hit as well. And then most recently, in 2007, Ratatouille. Brad Bird joining us, along with our animation critic, historian, and author Charles Solomon. Gentlemen, great to have you with us on Air Talk.
Great to be here again, Larry.
Brad, it is a pleasure. I wanted to ask you about the kinds of response that you've gotten now to your three films, batting three for three in what's a very difficult genre in which to work.
It's not a genre. It's a medium.
Your medium, pardon me. A very difficult medium in which to work. Your thoughts on the fact that your films have connected so well?
Well, it's kind of like objects are closer than they appear. I think that I'm in trouble if I even start to worry about that. I think that each time you go to bat, you're somewhat in the dark, and you're just trying to make something that you would like to watch. So I've been fortunate in getting to make the films that I set out to make, and it's all mystery to me.
Well, in doing them for yourself, clearly, you have some sort of affinity for what audiences want to see.
Well, I'm a movie lover. I'm a movie goer, you know, and I like to sit there and crunch popcorn and go ooh and ah and oh and ha ha, you know. So I think that movies kind of appeal to a sort of a dream-like state, and I think they appeal to the part of us that you know wants to be taken on a journey and have our emotions engaged.
Charles,
but I think making them for yourself is one of the key elements. That's what Walt Disney did. That's what Chuck Jones and the Warner's artists do. That's what Hayao Miyazaki does. It's not a question of a bunch of executives getting together and discussing, you know, what might appeal to people. It's, this is a story I want to hear. I want to hear the story of this character or these characters, and let's tell it properly.
I would give a lot of credit to Pixar for being a company whose business model is sort of all about what, you know, used to run the movie business, which is instinct, where people sit in a room and if they like an idea and they're engaged by it, their analysis doesn't go any deeper than that. There's no focus groups. They don't pretest the title. Certainly if they'd tested Ratatouille, it would have totally failed. I mean, it's three, you know, relatively unsexy movie ideas. You know, it's a rat and it's cooking and it's France. I mean, those three things together don't smell box office, heaven. So I think that it was more about the main character and what kind of situations the character could get in and how impossible is the goal and what kind of fun can we have with this. And that's as deep as it goes, which is how, you know, nobody says that the old movie moguls were great guys. But they did, you know, use their instinct and they just reacted to, I like that idea. Let's do a wrestling movie. You know, I mean, they didn't go any deeper than that.
With The Incredibles, I know that's a very personal project for you, something you'd really, you know, thought about doing and shepherded all the way from the very beginning. With Ratatouille, that had started before you came in and then it was re-envisioned and became your film. What is the difference in those two different scenarios?
Well, with The Incredibles, I remember the moment, you know, when I first had the idea and then toying with it over, like, you know, a decade, just, you know, constantly going back and tinkering with it in my mind. And with Ratatouille, I was involved with the project as part of this sort of core group that goes over all the Pixar films. We kind of all look over each other's shoulders, you know, Andy Stanton and John Lasseter and Joe Ranft and Pete Docter. We look at each other's work and when we're all getting a little too close to our own work, we provide, you know, fresh eyes. So I was aware of Ratatouille. I'd watched it, you know, be worked on for 5 years. And so I was up to speed on it. But it was very different in the sense that it was not a movie that I was emotionally engaged with at the beginning. And I sort of had to find my way into it. And that was through the main character. I mean, which was really one of their main challenges when I got on involved was they didn't know who the main character was. I mean, when you looked at the, you know, I thought of voices that they could possibly have for it. And I said, do you have a list of all the people you're thinking of? And they gave me this list. It was like a page and a half. And if you have a page and a half of people that could be right for it, you basically don't know who the character is. So, you know, I was fortunate in the guy that was my number one choice was not on the list. And that was Patton Oswalt. And he really helped us, you know. But that to me was the character because it had to be somebody who was just if somebody's going to try to take on the mountain of trying to cook in a kitchen that where people are out to kill you, it has to be somebody who's seized by passion and doesn't see anything but the goal. And Patton was so volatile and had such strong feelings about things and was really funny about it, but absolutely. You know, if he loved something, he loved it. And if he hated something, he hated it. And that kind of big personality was perfect for the character.
And in return, you almost drowned him.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, method acting.
Brad Bird, animator and writer, joining us on Air Talk. His most recent film, Ratatouille, released last year to great acclaim. It's out now on DVD as we head into
and
this
Blu-ray.
And Blu-ray, which is Disney's preferred format.
If you have a display device, particularly if you can get a big image, the Blu-ray will knock your socks off. So, Blu-ray.
All right.
But you had to get up to speed on that film rather quickly, didn't you? Because you came on, what, 18 months?
Yeah. Well, ago? Part of, you know, John Lasseter and Steve Jobs and Ed Catmull sort of came to me and said that, you know, that they wanted me to consider coming on to it. They believed in the idea firmly and felt like it was a project that needed to get made but also needed a shakeup, kind of like Toy Story 2 needed. So I sort of committed to the original release date. The only thing I can promise, I'll only make two promises. One is I'll hit the date. Animation will start when it needs to start and it will deliver when it's scheduled to deliver. And it won't look out of picture. It won't look out of place in a Pixar family photo. You know, it won't look like the deformed child of the mailman. Other than that, I can't tell you where it's going to be. You know, just that it won't be an embarrassment. And they just went ahead with it, and it was really scary, but it was also exhilarating. It was kind of like running in front of a freight train, kind of like that Wallace and Gromit cartoon.
Yeah, well, so one of the animators said it was like you announced, I'm jumping out of a plane and knitting a parachute on the way down, and I need you to jump with me.
Yes.
We'll continue our conversation with animator and writer Brad Bird, Charles Solomon, animation critic, author, and historian of Amazon.com, joining us as well. We'll hear more from Brad Bird in a much longer segment coming up. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by the Cedars-Sinai Center for Minimally Invasive Gynecological Surgery, providing minimally invasive techniques to treat the full range of gynecological conditions like endometriosis, ovarian cysts, and fibroids, which can cause infertility and pain. Cedars-Sinai is one of the few centers in Los Angeles using these techniques. To make an appointment, you can call 1-800-CEDARS-1, 1-800-CEDARS-1. Cedars-Sinai, leading the quest for health.
This is 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Hetty Lynn Hurtis. Another winter storm pummeled California over the weekend. KPCC's Steve Julian says it stranded several hikers.
The storm brought so much snow, the visibility in the Tehachapi Mountains, about an hour's drive north of Los Angeles, was down to zero. Like a storm last week, this one cut off the most direct route between Southern and Central California, Interstate 5. 10 inches of snow fell on Yosemite National Park in the Sierra Nevada Mountains.
Plows couldn't keep up, and two of the three main roads into the park were closed yesterday afternoon. Farther north in Lake Tahoe, two expert skiers disappeared. And in Southern California, a 53-year-old woman from Riverside was reported missing. She had taken the Palm Springs aerial tramway to its 8,500-foot upper base and set out to hike to the top of Mount San Jacinto. Two Marine Corps sergeants were rescued from the icy mountain yesterday. Steve Julian, 89.3, KPCC.
Still that SIG alert at LAX. The 405 South La Cienega on-ramp is closed for Caltrans work. In Mid-City, the 10 East jammed from Fairfax to Hoover Street. It's 11:41.
Support comes from Miramax Films and the Coen Brothers motion picture No Country for Old Men. Now nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Supporting Actor, and Best Picture of the Year. Now playing.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Brad Bird, the director of Ratatouille, joins us. Ratatouille is a very successful follow-up to The Incredibles and his first feature-length animated film, The Iron Giant. He also responsible for television animation before moving into features. And his first feature, as we mentioned earlier, hand-drawn, The Iron Giant, now working in computer animation with Pixar, Disney. Ratatouille is out on DVD and Blu-ray and up for serious award consideration. Brad, you've already had some honors, haven't you?
We've gotten a couple, yeah. Just was at AFI lunch.
Right?
Yeah, that's really a blast to go there because they don't have winners. They just have 10 films that they like. And
that's even a better idea. That's
kind
of nice,
fun.
Isn't it?
Yeah, you don't have to make speeches or anything. You just sit there and drink and eat and see cool people.
Charles, you know, we've talked a lot on our Film Week program about animation getting its due, and you've argued, and I think quite persuasively, that animation often ends up ghettoized because of its own category. When movies like Ratatouille and The Incredibles should be considered for Best Picture overall status. And, you know, your thoughts on that?
Very much. You know, I think things like most of the Guild Awards, the annual snub animation-a-thons. You know, why isn't a Ratatouille or Spirited Away nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay when they clearly warrant it? And this is at a time when animation occupies such a disproportionate piece of the box office, that there are maybe a dozen animated films each year, but that's a great big chunk of the box office for the successful ones, you know, like all the Pixar films. And they're also the films that are made, I know this isn't a trendy term, but the sort of the old-fashioned way, with the idea that you can go there with your 5-year-old kid and your 85-year-old grandmother, and you'll all have a good time at them, that there's something for the most and least sophisticated members of the audience.
Well, and that really gets to writing, Brad, and we should talk about that. I mean, how you're able, and other Pixar films have this ability, too, to refine the script to get it at such a level that the film really can succeed. Because it seems to me so much of feature animation, non-Pixar, falls down when it comes to the script.
Well, I think script is the most elusive thing. I think that, you know, the kind of business model that people come into the film business, and I think there's more people with business school degrees that are running things, they're always trying to look for repeatability, you know, and they're trying to look for something they can identify. That's why when someone other than Disney made money with CG animation, everyone suddenly thought, that's it. You know, computers will make money. All we have to do is do one of these bad things with a computer and everyone will love it. So they're trying to do that. They do that with stars. The star is a hit in one movie and they think, well, the star is the repeatable thing. So all we have to do is pay that star. But really, it's story and storytelling, and that the actors are definitely part of that, and all of the pieces that go into a movie are coming to play. But those are elusive things. You know, you don't, if you think about it in a logical way, what your goal is as a filmmaker is you're trying to entertain somebody you'll never meet, probably, thousands, millions of people you'll never meet, and what they'll like 2 or 3 years from now. And if you think about, okay, that's my job, that's what I need to go ahead and accomplish, you'll just go insane because it's too complicated, it's too abstract. But if you can go down to the basic level of what would intrigue me, what where would I expect the story to go and where could the story go that would surprise me but be logical, and just kind of fumble your way through the dark. And I think that it is not a foolproof method, but it's the best one that there is. And that hasn't changed as long as there's been movies.
Well, I don't think you do much fumbling, Brad, because one of the things that
I fumble.
I know. Well,
we just don't see them.
Yeah, that's right. I close the door.
But for example, and one of the things that I noticed in Ratatouille the second or third time I saw it was that you plant clues or things that will pay off when you need them to. As for example, you have just a little scene of Linguini and Colette roller skating at one point, and you see he knows how to, she doesn't, so that when he has to be the waiter all by him, the entire wait staff that one night, and he's roller skating around, it's just, oh yeah, he can roller skate. We've seen him do that. We know he can.
That's the one thing he can do well. Yeah, well.
You know, back to the issue of writing, how difficult do you think it is, you know, bringing together the element of the artist, even if you don't animate anymore? Fact is, you are an artist and also a writer. And clearly there are some people in this business who seem to have that ability to go between these two talents, and others not. And I wonder if you could unpack that a bit for us. I mean, do you feel like there is a shift in your brain when you're either writing or if you're artistically working with a visual creation?
Well, because I don't think about it compartmentally. I don't shut off the visual part of my brain when I start writing, even though it probably is not going to come tremendously into play in you know, more than half the scenes. I mean, you know, oftentimes it's characters, you know, just relating. But I oftentimes imagine shots right when I'm imagining something for the first time. At Disney, when I first went there, the method was you get the story beats down, then you do storyboards that work out the business that the character does, you know, how the characters, you know, funny little comedy things that they do. And it didn't really get into camera angles until later, which is the layout stage. And when I first started, like, you know, making suggestions for storyboards, they thought I was being specific. I remember arguing with a guy who's now a director there, in the parking lot, you know, saying, well, you know, you're getting specific too early. You know, you're limiting yourself. And I felt like, no, this is the way I see it. If somebody comes up with a better way to do it, we can always change it. But if nobody does, then this will work really well. And you're asking me to not think the way I think. And to me, it's visual handwriting, and that you know, shots tell you much about it's like choosing words when you're forming a sentence. A shot can tell you a lot about the psychology of the scene. So I have trouble.
So the visual is right in there. I mean, it's fascinating to me that one isn't intrusive into the other, but there's a synthesis between them. And this, as you're describing this and the specificity of this, it reminds me of what you were saying earlier about the list of the voiceover talent being considered for Remy, and how you looked at that and said, well, there really is no vision for this character because these people are all have very different personas through their voice. So is this just how you're wired? You've got that level of clarity that you can zone in on what you're looking for?
Well, I would hesitate to say that I've got some kind of magic answer because, you know, I fumble in the dark along with it. You know, I was lucky enough to meet one of my heroes and get to know him a bit, who's screenwriter and director Robert Towne, who did Chinatown and you know, Personal Best and a whole bunch of movies that are really great, Shampoo and Last Detail. And anyway, Chinatown was often cited in these screenplay books as being like the perfect screenplay. And they go, well, see, on page 23, he did this, and this is exactly what he needs to do. And as he should, he did this revelation on page 37. And I asked him, you know, hey, what was that like for you? And he's like, I was just feeling my way through it, and I didn't know what I was doing. And you know, I fought with Roman a lot. I didn't want the girl to die at
Polanski,
the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't want Faye Dunaway to die. And you know, I told him that he ruined it. And now I realized he was right. And you know, in other words, the guy who did the perfect screenplay was you know, not sure. And that's kind of, you know, I guess I am getting more comfortable with being in the dark and feeling like I will find my way out. But I don't want to give anybody the impression that this is like not a scary or, you know, a totally clear journey.
It just comes easily right off the top.
Well, you know, it takes a lot of work.
But Brad, the visuals are kind of built into much of your work. In Ratatouille, some of the most effective sequences are in mime, when Remy is in the bottle and it's just nodding or shaking his head at Linguini.
Well, in that instance, it helps to have animated, because I know, you know, some moments are hard to write in screenplays. Oftentimes, comedies, if it's not in the writing, if it's in gestures or in the timing of something, it's hard to put that in a screenplay where somebody can read it. So I have empathy for anybody. You know, I mean, I spent a long time in development hell, you know, trying to get films made. And those are the kinds of things it's very hard to read. You can do funny lines, but it's hard to write visual comedy in a way that everyone will get. Whereas if you can draw it, or you can present it some way, or stand there and describe how somebody's standing, like do it for somebody, then it becomes clearer to see. And unfortunately, I think that there's less purely visual comedy for that reason, because you can't write it in a way that's going to survive the salmon run that a movie has to go through to come into being.
Well, the other example of that is when Remy wakes up, or rather Remy is trying to wake Linguini up in the kitchen after he's been drunk, and it's that amazing bit of mime. But
how do you move a guy who's asleep? You know, well, you can describe that a little bit. But if I weren't in a situation where they trusted me, you know, at Pixar to just go ahead and start doing it, putting it in a visual mode, both in storyboards and then in animation, I'd be in trouble for that kind of moment.
Brad Bird with us on Air Talk, director and screenwriter. Ratatouille, his most recent film, released last year, up for all kinds of serious award consideration. That followed on the heels of the extremely successful The Incredibles, which was a project, as he said earlier, he'd had in mind for a decade before he was able to bring that to the screen. And if you've not seen his first feature-length film, The Iron Giant, this is a must-see. Beautiful, hand-drawn film, a very moving story, works on so many different levels, as Brad's films do, and I just want to highly recommend it. It's, of course, out on DVD and also gets shown on cable fairly regularly as well. I want to talk a little bit about the collaborative process. I mean, obviously, animation is something where you're part of this huge team that's making a film work. So you're a manager as well as a director. And what are the ways that you've evolved as a director? What are the things that you feel you've successfully worked on or improved on, or that you're still working on?
Well, I tried to direct films for a long time, and it was hard because I wanted to do my own things, and people don't want you to do your own things generally. They, you know, if they're willing to take a flyer with you, they usually want to assign you to something that maybe you can figure out a way to do. But I think that if I had made a film in my early 20s the way I wanted to, I think that it might have worked out. But I don't think that I had the patience that I think you need to have as a director. And I think that having kids and having a lot of disappointment early on taught me that, of like waiting for moments. And there are moments when people, whether it's creative people or financial people or whatever, there are moments where the timing is not right, and you kind of wait for the moment when they're able to receive an idea, and then you come in with it. And oftentimes, even though you might know where you want to go, you can't force people to that moment sometimes before they're ready. So you'll try to kind of open the door and then shine a little spotlight a little farther down the room and kind of make it a little more warm and inviting down there and try to coax them into it, because then it's going to be more of an honest thing from them. So I think that that's part of it.
Well, within animation, Brad is known as someone who can rally the troops even when they're dealing with the more restricted budget, say, as you were on Iron Giant.
Yes,
and
yeah.
The consensus is that for Brad, you'll walk off the cliff because you believe the airplane will come up and you'll step onto the wing at just the right moment.
Yes. Yeah, you got to keep that payola going for that plane. Yeah.
What is your next project that you're presumably working on now?
It's actually a live-action film, and I can't really talk about it in too much detail, but it's based on historical events. It's kind of half real stuff and half fictional characters. It's big, and there's no possibility of a sequel. So, knock on wood that it'll make it up the Salmon Run. But I'm very excited about it.
So, yeah, this wouldn't be for Pixar, presumably,
well,
since it's live action.
There is a Pixar involvement connection. It's not something I can elaborate
okay.
on. But I'm not ready to leave that womb-like atmosphere just yet, because it's a great place to. Bring stories into being.
Are you far enough along in this that you can talk generally about the difference of directing live action versus animation?
Not on more than a theoretical level. I've directed a little bit of live action. I've done a live action commercial, and I've done tests in live action, and I've certainly developed a lot of live action projects that didn't go along with the ones that didn't go in animation. I've been involved. I wrote a live action Amazing Stories and
the Steven Spielberg series.
Yes, yeah.
And did the only animated Amazing Stories.
That's right.
That Family Dog.
That's
yours.
Right. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to it. But I'm certainly going to go in with my eyes wide open and try to do all my homework and plan it as well as I can.
Brad, can you talk a little bit more about directing the animators, particularly in, say, that sequence of Remy in the jar that's so subtle, but what the character is thinking there, the way you do in the best drawn animation or in Nick Park's 3D animation?
Well, what you're trying to really, there's not much difference between talking to an animator about doing a scene and talking to an actor about a scene. I mean, I was involved in theater and back in Oregon and thought about going into it at one point.
Oh.
And so things got very Giacchino there for a second. I would just say that you approach it from a character point of view and try to put the animator in the mind of the character, and then it's going to go someplace interesting.
Brad Bird, pleasure to have you with us again on Air Talk. Congratulations on your films, which deliver the goods on so many different levels.
Thank you.
It's a real accomplishment. Thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Ratatouille is his most recent film that he directed and wrote following The Incredibles and The Iron Giant. Charles Solomon, always appreciate your joining us for animation and interviews on Air Talk.
Always a pleasure, Larry.
Thanks very much. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC, Southern California Public Radio. Have a wonderful day.